It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. This week, our critics are Leo Lowenstein, Charles Solomon, animation critic, and Tim Cogshell. We have many films to talk about this week, beginning with Uncut Gems. Adam Sandler stars as a New York jeweler, Kevin Garnett, former NBA star, and Idina Menzel in the cast as well. The film is written and directed by the Safdie brothers, Benny and Josh, also contributing to the screenplay, Ronald Bronstein. Leo, please start us with Uncut Gems.
Yeah, this is actually an outstanding film, and I think it's one of the top films of the year. So Sandler plays Howard, the tightly coiled, gambling-addicted, risk-addicted guy who's having an affair on his wife, played by Idina Menzel, with this gorgeous woman who works in his jewelry shop, played by Julia Fox. He is trying to juggle all his balls and keep them in the air. When everything starts to come down, he insists, no, he can keep doing this. What I love about the Safdie brothers is their mastery of tone. They did a couple years ago called Good Time with Robert Pattinson, which is so strong. It's similar kind of tonally in that it has the sense of, you have a sense of dread, but at the same time this propulsive energy that keeps moving the film forward. So it's like a modern urban noir, but not so much in the sense of the visuals, although there are kind of noir stylistic elements, but more just the way they cut, the way they move, and their use of Adam Sandler here is just outstanding. I've never seen his kind of tightly coiled intensity work to better effect than it does here. It's really good.
Tim, what do you think of Uncut Gems?
Well, it is quite good. Intensity is the thing that the Safdie brothers work with. They start a film out going 60 miles an hour and keep applying the gas.
Although, interestingly, it does begin with his colonoscopy.
With the colonoscopy, so yeah. But even then, he has this expression on his face that's extremely intense.
Well, that sounds intense.
Yeah.
Right.
And so this is what they do. Every now and again, Adam Sandler reminds us what a really wonderful actor he can be when he wants to.
Punch Drunk Love.
Oh yeah, you know. So he can get there. The brothers here are working with all kinds of things, including this extremely powerful sort of score, mm-hmm. done by a guy named Daniel Lapaine. Sort of a synth, crazy, clashing,
yeah.
clanging score. And this score starts to get to you, and it's horrible, but it's perfect. It is exactly correct for everything that's happening in this movie.
It's
the way
true.
This score is clawing at your eyes.
Yeah. Yeah, well put. And also, I think the sense of
yeah.
this,
no eyes.
If there's anything this movie makes you feel, it's stressed out. It's like you have this
yeah.
this sense of, you know, impending disaster. And there's so many kind of wonderful visual metaphors too, as well. The way so Kevin Garnett basically is a prospective client of Adam Sandler's. He's very interested in this opal that Sandler has had brought over from Ethiopia, which is worth anywhere from $150,000 to $1 million, depending on who you ask and what mood Sandler is in. And Garnett's interested in the opal, and he wants to borrow it, essentially, which leads to all kinds of complications and bad things. But the notion of the opal, through which you can see all kinds of different kinds of light, and Garnett believes it's a token of good luck for him. And then the glass crashing that Sandler's telling him constantly, don't lean on that glass, don't lean on that glass. That's like an omen of, well, also yeah. what's going to happen. And also the use of contrasting interior spaces and exterior spaces, the way the outside is this urban grit of New York City, and then the interior kind of shiny, glossy apartments.
Yeah, the brothers overcome a thing, too. There's a basketball game, the championship game. And the thing of it is, we know how that game ends, because it's 2012. So we know how that game ends, but it doesn't make any difference. The knot in your stomach, even as that big
yeah.
scene is playing out, with them locked in the thing and all that kind of stuff. And I'm thinking to myself, I know how this game is, but I'm still sitting here. That's how good they are at constructing these
moments.
Oh,
and that also, that terrific scene where he's at his school, his kid's school play, and he's being tailed by these mobsters who want money. He owes them a lot of money. He has to run out of the play. He gets stripped naked and locked in the car at one point, and he has to call his ex-wife from the cell phone inside the trunk of the car to come and rescue him. I mean, that's the kind
thing
of tension.
I think it's still his current wife, because he keeps talking about them getting getting together.
Well, they're splitting. They're on the verge of splitting up. He keeps saying so. Well, you're right.
Karen, Charles, yeah. What do you think of it?
I'm more the dissenter here. In the first place, I think if you took the N-word and the F-bombs out of the script, it would have been about 6 pages long.
That's true.
And if you cut out the unnecessary shots of people walking back and forth, you'd get a movie that was 20 minutes shorter.
True.
I was not as wowed by it. I think, yes, it builds tension. I don't know that it's a huge stretch for Adam Sandler to be obnoxious. But a lot of it, I just wasn't buying. I mean, yes, there are opals from Ethiopia, but they are not nearly as valuable as Australian ones. So maybe knowing that kind of let some of the air out of the tires for me.
Let me defend those F-bombs and that N-word in this movie. Lakeith Stanfield in the movie, Kevin Garnett, all these young
so
black
good.
Men.
So good.
Kevin Garnett was really...
Really good.
I'm like, really?
Yeah.
Kevin Garnett, really?
I know.
He's that good in this movie.
I agree about him, yes.
And these fellas, you know, doing what they do, they talk that way. And I will say this about Adam. That's a character that he has built. That's not Adam Sandler.
That's his persona.
That's not any of the characters that I've seen Adam Sandler play. Even the silly guys that he plays. That is like the teeth, the thing with the teeth.
Yeah, he's got fake teeth.
And I'm like, no, that's a character. That's a complete guy. And frankly, I've known some guys like that. These guys that are always on the edge, always trying to pull in the big bet, always trying to bring the big one home. And every now and again.
I will say also, I don't think this is a movie that's easy to like, but it is worth your deep appreciation and your you know, your high regard.
Well, yeah, the Safdie brothers movies are not easy to like.
Yeah.
They're not likable movies.
They're kind of
experiences.
Dirty, you know.
So
yeah.
for people who are Adam Sandler fans and go to this film, they may get a rude awakening.
Oh yeah. This is not going to be any Adam Sandler you've ever seen before. So maybe I'm not sure you should go if you're expecting a Sandler film.
No, his vampire is more sympathetic in Hotel Transylvania.
But he does great work here, though. He really does. I think he gets to a whole new level.
Uncut Gems is the film starring Adam Sandler, Kevin Garnett, and Idina Menzel. Benny and Josh Safdie, the brothers, are the directors and co-screenwriters. It's rated R in wide release. Bombshell takes us inside the Fox News channel. A group of women take on the head of Fox News, Roger Ailes. The movie is directed by Jay Roach. It stars Margot Robbie, Charlize Theron, and Nicole Kidman. Here, Roger Ailes talks to higher-ups of Fox News about accusations from anchor Gretchen Carlson.
A TV outfit needs tough, confident women. Do I push them? You bet your ass I do. But have I ever demanded sex during a casting session? I defy you to find any evidence that a single part of what these women are saying is true. Get ready. More will come. We need to let Rupert know what it means if I lose. Gretchen Carlson could kill Fox News. This is a fight for your jobs. If I go, you go.
John Lithgow portraying Roger Ailes in the film Bombshell. Leah, what do you think?
Oh, Lithgow was very good in this, by the way. You can almost see the spit coming out of his mouth and the smoke coming out of his ears. He's a very intense Roger Ailes. I mostly liked this film. I had a few problems with it. So you have Nicole Kidman as Gretchen Carlson, you have Charlize Theron as Megyn Kelly, and you have Margot Robbie as a sort of composite character who is like the new hire, who Christian, she's comes from the Midwest, and she's, you know, trying to make her way in the big city. Each of these represents a different facet of what turns out to be sexual harassment or the female experience at Fox. And to different degrees, I think it's extremely well acted. Theron, in particular, wearing prosthetics, is unrecognizable as herself, but so good as Megyn Kelly. She gets the voice, she gets the mannerisms, and it doesn't feel like a copycat performance at all. It feels like she's really kind of inhaled Megyn Kelly. I liked Kidman's performance a little bit less, but I felt she had less to do. And then the same with Robbie. I think Tim's going to talk about it. She's a complicated character because she is an amalgam or a composite. Kate McKinnon, on the other hand, is in a supporting plays a closeted lesbian Democrat who works at Fox News, and she represents sort of the underside that people don't know about or talk about. Each of these women has to deal with sexual harassment in the workplace. The fact that at Fox, it's not how good your reporting is; it was how short your skirt is or how much makeup you're wearing. That in itself is troubling. They help bring Roger Ailes down through the various degrees of confessing that they do, and whether or not they face the truth. To me, it felt limited in that I guess it's the experience that we're having outside of the film right now that, there's just a piece in the LA Times. There's no women nominated for a directing Oscar. Women have come so far since the Me Too movement, but really, have they at all? Mm. That was the frustrating part of it for me, is I think it didn't really add up to very much. It's just sort of a slice of this particular event.
What do you think of Bombshell?
Well, the film walks us through the machinations of what happened to these women, the women that actually existed. We're with them and their lawyers quite a lot as they sort of strategize what they're going to do about all of this. We meet Mark Duplass, Gretchen's husband.
Right.
And a very supportive guy. Yeah, so the film leaves us liking all of these women quite a lot. Now, what you call an amalgamation character, I call made up.
Same thing.
But made up in this sort of very particular way to achieve these very, very particular notions. Now, there's a scene in this movie, and the scene I'm talking about between Margot Robbie's made up character, and Lithgow as Ailes. Lithgow, who he looked like John Lithgow in a Roger Ailes suit.
I disagree.
So earlier this year we had Russell Crowe,
right, in the loudest voice, the Showtime miniseries about Roger Ailes,
and he inhabited that.
All right.
So here I always saw John Lithgow. But nevertheless, in this one particular scene with Margot Robbie, where this very heinous thing happens, they give us that scene with this made-up character, which is, and I get it. You just can't do that.
I think it's okay to actually talk about what happens. I don't think it's giving anything away. She's coming in for an interview with him, and he asks her to just do a pirouette for him because TV is a visual medium, and then asks her just to lift her skirt a little bit higher.
And a little bit higher,
nothing much more than that ensues in that scene. But it's absolutely heartbreaking because you see her soul crumbling in that moment, and her visions of what she thought it was to be a success in news media absolutely destroyed, decimated. So that's the most powerful scene in the movie to me.
Tim, using composite characters is pretty common in biopics, things like, what bothered you about the character Robbie plays here?
Because the very specific thing that Lale just described now accrues to Roger Ailes. Folks who watch this movie will accrue that moment to Roger Ailes. Well, that moment couldn't have happened because that character doesn't exist. A moment like that might have happened. But if a moment like that might have happened, the things that Gretchen Carlson and the characters, we can ascribe those things to fact as they saw it. You can read them in their books. That specific moment did not happen because that character does not exist.
So does that pull you out of the film?
Yes, it does. Okay. Because this is what this film is actually basically doing. It's saying that Roger Ailes was this horrible monster of a person who did all of these things to these women, many of which are absolutely true. I don't think you have to spend one moment making anything up. Once you make something up, you diminish it.
I disagree, Tim. I'm sorry, but I think it becomes symbolic of the entire culture of discrimination against women and harassment in the workplace. Whether you're talking about Roger Ailes in that moment or alluding to Harvey Weinstein or Matt Lauer, and I think there are allusions both direct and indirect in this movie to those men, I think it does not diminish the overall content or message of the film. I actually disagree.
I don't know. I'm going to have to push back against that because I know that there's a way that you can use a moment like that in the film to make that point. You simply have both of the characters be fictitious. You just make up a moment.
But I
don't think that it is fair to ascribe a wholly fictitious moment because the character is fictitious to an actual person. And we're going to have this conversation exactly again in about 5 minutes when we talk about Richard Jewell.
That was the culture that went on there and that to some extent still goes on. The problem that I had with the Margot Robbie character is different from the one that you had. I had a problem with the fact that her story gets tied up in a neat little bow at the end that felt entirely disingenuous to me. But I didn't have the same problem that you had with her.
I do have a larger problem with this movie, though, not just that.
Okay.
This movie's funny. This movie opens funny. It's funny all the way through. I don't think it ought to be so funny.
All right, Bombshell is the film we're talking about. Margot Robbie, Charlize Theron, and Nicole Kidman star Jay Roach directs. Charles Randolph wrote the screenplay. It's rated R in wide release. We got so many more movies to talk about. We'll hear what our critics think in 1 minute. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by critics Leah Lowenstein, Tim Cogshell, and Charles Solomon. A lot of big movies this week, and this is what we see this time of year. We get to December. It's big release time, films trying to qualify for Oscar consideration and to be available when larger number of people on vacation can go to the movies, particularly in a challenging weather on the East Coast. We don't have that problem here, though, that's for sure. Next up is the latest installment in the Jumanji series, Jumanji The Next Level. Dwayne Johnson, Jack Black, Kevin Hart star, the film directed by Jake Kasdan, who co-wrote the screenplay. Tim.
Well, you know, I happened to be on the show for the previous Jumanji, a movie that I really, really enjoyed.
Yeah, remember, you really liked it, yeah.
And was so surprised how much I enjoyed that
And that
movie.
Was a smash film. Oh, it made a ton of money.
And then there it went, and thus we have another. And all of the same characters back, and they get back into the game. We have two new elements. You see them in the trailer, Danny Glover and Danny DeVito. Spencer's grandfather and his best friends, who had this business together that they ran for years and years, but Danny Glover retired and Danny DeVito never forgave him for it, and haven't spoken to each other in 15 years. They end up in this game. Danny DeVito is Dwayne Johnson's character, and Danny Glover is Kevin Hart's character. Okay, now this is interesting. Previously in the game, one of the young characters was a young black man, and he ended up in Kevin Hart's body. Right? Now, he ends up in Jack Black's body in this film. You know, I was a bit of a hypocrite when I'm watching this movie. Previously in Jack Black's body, there was this sort of teenage valley girl. So Jack was doing this sort of teenage valley girl through that whole previous movie. In this movie, the brother is in Jack's body. So Jack's kind of like doing this brother a little bit. And I'm watching
Does it work?
He's hysterical. But I found myself thinking, hey, man, I don't know if I'm okay with this. And then Danny DeVito is in Dwayne Johnson's body, and Danny's, you know, this old nebbishy Jewish guy, and Dwayne is like, hey, oh, he's doing this joke. And this movie, and then they start switching bodies in the movie, and it's hysterical. So the Valley Girl gets back in Jack Black's body, and he has to switch back to doing her. So I said black, I can't remember. And they're just switching these bodies and switching personas, and all of these characters, all of these actors are doing all these people, and it's just cracking me up. But it did point out to me just how a bit of a hypocrite I was when I had a tiny little issue with Jack Black doing that brother. But I had no issue whatsoever with Dwayne Johnson doing the little Jewish guy.
So will little Jewish old man offended by what Dwayne Johnson does?
So you know what? I had to turn all of those switches off and go with the movie. All kinds of wacky things go on in this movie. Awkwafina is in the movie. She's hysterical. She's doing Danny Glover too. Awkwafina doing Danny Glover. Awkwafina doing Danny DeVito. They're just all switching these characters. It just cracked me up. I'm sorry. These movies are funny, and you know I'm gonna have to turn in my film critic credential.
Charles, you're gonna say something?
Yeah. Well, wasn't Kevin Hart also the voice of the rabbit in the Secret Life of Pets?
The
book?
White
Snowball.
The white rabbit.
Yes.
which I mentioned on the show too.
Jumanji, The Next Level. Tim sure likes it. Dwayne Johnson, Jack Black, Kevin Hart star. Jake Kasdan direct and co-wrote. Jumanji, The Next Level's in wide release, rated PG-13. The latest film from Clint Eastwood is his historical drama, Richard Jewell, based on the story of the American security guard who saved thousands of lives from an exploding bomb at the 1996 Olympic Games in Atlanta, but who ended up being vilified by journalists. In this scene, Jewell's mother gives a press conference.
The media has portrayed my son as the person who has committed this crime. They have taken all privacy from us. They have taken all peace. The FBI follows his every move. And why? My son is innocent. Mr. President, please clear my son's name.
Kathy Bates, portraying Richard Jewell's mother, Billy Ray, wrote the screenplay, which is based on a 1997 Vanity Fair article by Marie Brenner. Paul Walter Hauser and Sam Rockwell star in Richard Jewell. Lael?
So I have mixed feelings about this film, and I should confess that, you know, with the power of the press, the name Richard Jewell, to me, before I went and saw the movie and thought about the whole story behind it, I had some vague association. Wasn't he the guy with that Atlanta bombing thing that, you know, wasn't he the guy who did that? So whether or not he did, and he didn't, he's exonerated in this movie, and you see his story. It's a fairly even-handed biopic, although we'll get into that because the Atlanta Journal-Constitution is having some issues with the way it's portrayed. He did clear his name, but was not able to clear it for history. I think my point is simply that bad press can stick no matter what. Now, the movie's been in the press this week because the Atlanta Journal-Constitution is angry with the characterization of its reporter for having misrepresented facts.
Yeah, Kathy Scruggs, played by Olivia Wilde,
mm-hmm.
In the movie. Richard Jewell, I remember that. I remember all of this very, very well.
And boy, his name was everywhere.
It was everywhere, and more or less what happened is played out in this movie. How he was this hero who found this bomb in this trash can, cleared all of these people out. Still, I think one or two people were actually killed.
Two people,
nevertheless.
Many injured.
And for a moment, he was a hero. All switches in the course of about 3 days. There's an FBI agent who thinks that he might have done it. In the context of this film, a reporter played by Olivia Wilde, who's playing an actual human being who passed away, Kathy Scruggs, gets this information, prints this headline, FBI suspects hero guard may have planted bomb, turns Richard Jewell's life upside down, just as played out in this movie. That's all fine.
And that's all true. I mean, the fact that he was vilified, he went from being a hero immediately to being like, thought of as, you know, this crazy guy who impersonated a police officer.
Yeah. And he was a bit of a quirky, odd fellow
anyway.
He wanted to be in law enforcement, never could make his way into law enforcement, ended up being this sort of security guard guy. All true. Now, Richard Jewell, born in 62, died in 2007 at the age of 44. Over the course of this period, all the way back then, when his name was cleared, Richard Jewell had a bit of a life. For one thing, he went on to actually work in real law enforcement because of this. Richard Jewell appeared on Saturday Night Live. Richard Jewell appeared and a documentary about this entire period where he played himself, none of which shows up in this movie. In this movie, though, they portray Kathy Scruggs, an actual reporter who passed away, as having traded sex for the information that she got so that she could publish that story. There's no evidence of this whatsoever at all anywhere on the planet. It's
But as she's dead, there's no case chance for libel.
Yeah, well, yeah, as she is, in fact, dead. If she weren't, I promise you we'd be in court right now. Now, this is excellent filmmaking, and this is a very good film. Rockwell and Hauser, all of these people, Kathy Bates, they're just doing excellent work. And, of course, it's all being mastered and corralled by the wonderful filmmaker Clint Eastwood. But don't you see that makes it all the worse? This is a very good movie, and lots of people are going to see it. And they're going to come away from this movie thinking things that are absolutely not true. This movie also has other intentions. This movie wants to poke very specifically at law enforcement, the FBI, right now. This movie wants to poke at media in general, just what these reporters did here. But just in general, this movie is. Now, that's an intention pointed at today. That's a conservative filmmaker making a very conservatively pointed film about these events, none of which is untrue except for the one thing that's wholly untrue.
Now, I think, though, in the original Vanity Fair piece, and correct me if I'm wrong, the FBI comes off quite poorly in that piece on which this is based.
Yeah, and they come off poorly here. The FBI did not, they were not fantastic, but then there, like I say, there is an intention.
They coax and they cajole Richard Jewell into—they get him into the station or into the office by telling him that they think he's a hero and they need him to shoot a video about how to bring a suspect in. You know,
they manipulate him because they can tell that he is not all that sharp.
Jewell had one great goal, really, which was just to work in security, to do his job well. He has the sense of duty and diligence that is really pervasive throughout his character, and that was apparently true in his life. But I think that's sort of the overriding element of that character. And that, to me, I didn't find it as multidimensional or as complex, maybe as you did, Tim. I thought the film was sort of a little bit weak in that, other than these really strong individual performances, and I give Eastwood credit for bringing out a great performance from Hauser, who, by the way, played Jeff Galooly in I, Tonya. Yeah. He's an actor to watch. Kathy Bates, excellent as his mom. Sam Rockwell and John Hamm. I felt like it was sort of your standard kind of disaster guy who wants to be a kind of a hero who doesn't go down well. Mm. That, you know, I thought it was sort of a the wrong man kind of thing.
I see something slightly more pointed in some of the subtext.
I think there's subtext, and I do think he's going after the media, certainly.
Well, you know, this film originally was going to be Leonardo DiCaprio playing the Sam Rockwell part,
mm-hmm.
With Jonah Hill playing the Richard Jewell part.
And now they're both producers on this.
Yeah, but Paul Greengrass was slated to direct.
Really?
Yes.
That would have been a different movie.
A completely different movie.
Very different.
And what would not have been in the movie, I think, are the politics.
Yeah. Nevertheless, I think if you were to ask someone 20, 30 years later what the name Richard Jewell meant to them, they would think it had something to do with that bombing, but not necessarily know that he was exonerated.
Yeah. Janet Reno, in 1997, Janet Reno issued an apology to him. Mm. That's not in this movie.
Yeah.
Richard Jewell, Clint Eastwood directs, Billy Ray wrote the screenplay, Paul Walter Hauser and Sam Rockwell, Olivia Wilde, Kathy Bates, and John Hamm star. Rated R, it's in wide release. Black Christmas follows a group of sorority women as they're stalked by a killer during their Christmas break. This rather loose remake of the 1974 film of the same name, that too was remade back in 2006. The current Black Christmas stars Imogene Poots, Lily Donahue, Elise Shannon, and Brittany O'Grady. Sophia Takal is the director and co-screenwriter. Tim?
Yeah, this one remade and reshaped in very specific ways to sort of reflect issues of today around Me Too and things that have happened or sometimes alleged to have happened on college campuses with fraternities and sorority girls and all kinds of things that go down like that. So we have our young woman here who previously had accused a young man in a frat of sexually assaulting her, of drugging her and sexually assaulting her. He's let off. He comes back. The young woman is very nervous with her sorority sisters about the situation on campus. They put on this show, which is very pointed about all of this, and more or less calls out these frat boys as misogynists and sexists and sometimes rapists. This college where these young men happen to be going is one of these sort of like male sort of colleges, sort of like it's called Hawthorne and the thing. You think of a Harvard or something like that, and they have one of these founders who was a guy from 1865 who owned slaves and hated and wrote really horrible screeds against women and all, and they worship this guy. We end up in this movie.
Is this at all comedic or done totally straight?
It's done a little bit too straight for my taste. And I'll tell you another thing about this movie. It eventually gets to a spot that I rather enjoy because it gets to a spot where girls are hitting frat boys in the face with axes because, you know, they're angry about what has been going on. But I gotta tell you, this movie kills a whole lot of young women before it turns the tables. And I was a little bit uncomfortable with that. And I was also a little bit uncomfortable with how flatly it laid out its arguments about these things and how it wasn't a little bit more
subtle.
Well,
that's why the way you were describing it, I was wondering if it was a little bit tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, I wished it had been a little bit more tongue-in-cheek with all of this. But then again, that would be a different movie. Eventually, it goes to the spot that you know where it's going, where all these boys are going to pay for their crimes. And, you know, it gets us there, but I don't think it's going to be in the canon of at least that first film. I didn't see that second film.
Yeah, the first film, what was it about the original Black Christmas that made that such a cult film?
Same theme on a college campus, although it didn't have to do with frat boys specifically or a cultish magical bust, which this one has to do with.
And was that the director did Christmas Story did that?
Bob.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. Yeah, didn't he direct both those?
Yeah, yeah, and died tragically.
In a car accident.
Pacific Coast Highway.
Yeah, Black Christmas. Sophia Takal is the director and co-screenwriter with April Wolf. It stars Imogene Poots, Lily Donahue, Elise Shannon, and Brittany O'Grady. It's in wide release, rated PG-13. Let's at least get started. Bob Clark was the director.
That's who it was.
Yeah, did Porky's also. Yeah. That's quite a wide-ranging career. Cunningham, a 3D documentary profiling the modern dancer Merce Cunningham and his dance company. Charles, just start us about a minute, and then we'll take a break.
Okay. Well, Cunningham was, of course, one of the great choreographer dancers of the 20th century. He was John Cage's lover for many years, and they worked together. His work was so interesting that people like Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg and Andy Warhol did sort of sets and costumes as minimal as they were. And the one hypnotically beautiful sequence in this is from his the dance that they did with kind of a pointilliste background by Rauschenberg. And that's, what is it, Summer Space. And that sequence is stunning. And if the rest of the movie were that good, it would be something really special.
Do you wear 3D glasses for this?
No, I didn't see it in 3D. Couldn't get to the screening.
Today in the dancing, still impressive. We'll hear more what Lael and Tim thought of Cunningham, the 3D documentary on modern dancer Merce Cunningham and his company. The director is Ala Govgan. We'll have more on Film Week in 2 minutes. So good to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Tim Cogshell, Lael Lowenstein, and Charles Solomon. We're just starting off with Charles's thoughts about the 3D documentary Cunningham on dancer Merce Cunningham. Ala Govgan is the director of the film. Charles, continue, please.
Well, the film has two big problems, though. The first is, this is kind of the scrapbooking approach to documentary. You've got framing elements, you've got split screen, you've got writing appearing on the screen. You don't need that. Second is, dance is difficult to film because it's something very dimensional. It can flatten out. But by having a moving camera going through the dancers, you are adding an element to the dance that Cunningham didn't create, and it's often very distracting. Why, if you are shooting a dancer, do you move in so close that you can't see the dancer's legs or feet? And in one of the dances, there's archival footage that Cunningham had staged on a bare stage. It's just him moving with a partner. Very interesting ways, very dynamic. When they film it, it's behind these carved, cut-out wooden screens, so you're looking through an element, through the shadows, all of which is distracting you from that movement that is the point of the piece. And it's so completely unsympathetic to what Cunningham was trying to do, I just wanted to smack the director by the end of this.
All right, Lael, what did you think of Cunningham?
I liked it better than Charles. I did like it better than Charles. I think I
easy enough.
I thought, if you aren't necessarily indoctrinated into, you know, the world of Merce Cunningham or know that much about his dance, as certainly you do, I found it a worthy introduction to his style, and I found it actually pretty elucidating. I thought, you know, I learned quite a bit about him, and I thought it was absolutely stunning and beautiful to watch. I certainly see, you're right, there could have been more about other parts of his career. There could have been more about his work with Martha Graham and influence with her and so on and so forth, but I learned something from it.
And did you feel like you got to know Cunningham as a person or just as the artist?
To some extent, yes, I did. And I wasn't as bothered by the technological, the aspects of it that Charles was referring to, the split screen and so forth. It sort of worked for me.
Tim?
Well, I'll say that it more or less filled the bill for me, too. Yes, you're right. Yeah, he danced for Martha for 6 years. Mm-hmm. And they don't even mention it. She discovered him. That's kind of crazy. And he was with Cage for 50 years, until Cage died in 1991.
They were a couple for 50 years?
Yeah. Wow. And worked together during most of the time. He worked with Brian Eno. I mean, he was a person who was constantly changing and innovative and developing with the modern times. His idea was to combine ballet with modern dance. The notion was that from the hips down it would be ballet, and from the waist up it would be modern dance. And having himself explain it, and we hear his voice in the film, and then see it suddenly sort of crystallizes for you what he was doing. I'm like, oh, you know, duh, how come I couldn't see that? But now I understand it better because of this. You know, it is about the last few years of the company, of his life.
His first company.
Yeah, of his first company.
Yeah, but I wish they had had someone like Arlene Croce or Louis Siegel talking about some of the points Tim raised, that, yes, from Martha Graham he learned this, Paul Taylor learned from him. You know, this is not something that exists in isolation. He's being influenced. He's influencing what else is happening in dance then. And I think the context would have made you appreciate the singularity of his vision that much more.
Do you get a sense of his influence on the dancers who followed?
They don't talk about that at all, which I think is a real shortcoming of the film, that the company has changed. The original dancers, you know, are too old to perform such exacting work, and it is. But what have they gone on to do?
We don't. You know, and that's also a problem when there's, I don't know of any of the other documentaries on him. So this is, it ends up being sort of the definitive record if there's really nothing else to look at.
Yeah.
Cunningham, the 3D documentary profiling dancer Merce Cunningham and his dance company. Ala Kovkin is the director. The film's at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles, and it's rated PG. The documentary What She Said, The Art of Pauline Kael, is at the New Art Theater in West Los Angeles. Lael.
Well, Pauline Kael was, I think without question, the most influential and important film critic of the last century, maybe of all time.
We should have Peter Rayner here for this review, because he was considered one of the Paulettes, a disciple, so to speak, of Pauline Kael.
Right, exactly. That's where the term came about, was from those who kind of worshipped her and started writing in her style. She was to film criticism what the French New Wave was to the movies, in that she began writing with this great passion and love for the movie. She was first and foremost a movie fan and wrote movie notes for films in Berkeley, where she helped run the theater and used to have these salons in her living room where people would talk about movies afterwards. So she was a fan. And then when she started writing about movies, she colloquialized film criticism, which had been up until then this sort of stodgy Bosley Crowther writing for the New York Times in this very kind of formal kind of voice. She freed up the language. She began using the second person, you, in her writing. She wrote in a way that no one had ever seen before, and she was very, very polarizing. She could also piss people off, among them critic Andrew Saris, with whom she engaged in this notorious series of...
Who hasn't been outraged by one of her reviews? That's kind of part of the
genius. Is that our job?
But yeah, she's also beloved by many a filmmaker, including Quentin Tarantino and Woody Allen, who, you know, became her friends. The issue also, and what I liked about this film too, is that it's not just all positive stuff. It does show the negatives. It does show how she could hurt people. It does show how she could be a little hypocritical. She was a huge critic of the auteur style of Saris for popularizing the auteur style of in his work. But then she became great friends with Renoir and went on to espouse and promote certain filmmakers in her writing as well. So. Mm-hmm.
Who would have been, you know, recently thought of as auteurs.
Exactly. Very much so. Yeah, Allen, yeah. Among them. Yeah.
I like this movie a whole lot, too. Charles and I were talking a little bit. Charles didn't care that much for Pauline. You know, there are begets and begots in film criticism. So Pauline begot all those Paulettes, including Roger Ebert. Roger Ebert begot me. And the thing about her writing is she wrote the way she spoke. I met her once. But it was a long meeting, and it didn't take me very long to realize that in talking with Pauline Kael and reading Pauline Kael, you were hearing Pauline Kael. She came off the page exactly the way she came out of her mouth. She had a deep understanding of what film could do to us emotionally, and she rather hated it. She hated when films just pulled at our obvious strings, and I kind of hate that too. On the other hand, she understood that what film should do is explore all of the many human conditions, and then look at each one of those conditions from a different angle, from an oblique angle. She loved it when films did that. She loved it when the next thing that happened in a film was the unexpected but still possible thing. Mm. That's what she loved about cinema, and I love that too. You know, she had this sort of Upper East Side Manhattan sort of dynamic. She was born on a chicken farm in Petaluma, California, to Polish immigrant family.
She seems... I knew she was a Northern Californian. I assumed she was very citified, though.
Yeah, chicken farm.
She was. She became urban, though, and then eventually left it for Massachusetts.
She brained herself into Berkeley.
She did.
She had a big old brain.
Yeah, my one encounter with her was she was giving a talk in San Francisco in the late 80s, and I just remember asking, you know, what advice would you give to someone who wanted to become a film critic? And she said, don't do it.
Sounds like the advice I got from the radio people that I talked with as a kid, tried to steer me clear, and a lot of good that ended up doing.
There you go.
We're talking about the documentary What She Said, The Art of Pauline Kael. The documentary is at the New Art in West Los Angeles. It's unrated. Rob Garver is the director of the documentary. We have many more films to talk about on the program, but I do want to remind you that our Film Week Academy Awards preview is coming your way earlier in 2020 than in typical years because the Motion Picture Academy has moved the Oscars up into early February. So all the critics will be on stage at the Theater at Ace Hotel Sunday morning, February 2nd at 11 o'clock. We're also starting it earlier in the day because it's Super Bowl Sunday. We want you to be able to do both should you desire. So we'll start at 11 o'clock. You can have your brunch before or after our Film Week Academy Awards preview. Tickets are available at kpecc.org/in-person. We hope to see you Sunday morning, February 2nd at the Ace. Back in a minute. Good to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a terrific day. Also, last week's show, we told you about a documentary directed by Peter Jackson, They Shall Not Grow Old. It had been released earlier this year. It's back in theaters for an encore showing. This part of a series of Fathom event screenings of the films with 100% ratings on Rotten Tomatoes. There were 9 of them this year. So just wanted to let you know, They Shall Not Grow Old has screenings coming up next week in select theaters December 17th and 18th. You can check your local listings to see which theater near you They Shall Not Grow Old is going to be screening at. Out this week, the biographical pick A Hidden Life, starring August Diehl and Valerie Pashner, Terrence Malick, the writer-director. Lael?
This is certainly Malick's return to form. He is, of course, the filmmaker who did Days of Heaven and Badlands in the early and mid-70s and was really notable for that, and then took a 20-year hiatus before he did The Thin Red Line, which was a strong return, and then after that has sort of descended into weirdness and self-indulgence with some really unwatchable movies, including Song to Song.
Some of which are critically acclaimed.
Well, I had to suffer. Well, okay, Tree of Life.
I'm with you on this, but I just have to say
some people like
that.
Tree of Life. I found Song to Song to be absolutely execrable and unwatchable, one of the most painful experiences I've had in a while. Anyway, but so this, just to get back to it, is a really beautiful, lyrical, kind of expansive portrait of a man who's a, it's set around the time of World War II. He is a conscientious objector to the war, and you had to swear your allegiance to Hitler if you're an Austrian, and he refuses to do that. That becomes known in this very small village that he lives in. He gets called off to serve, and he refuses. So then the film alternates between his being incarcerated in this horrible, gritty, grungy prison and these beautiful pastoral shots of his wife, Fanny, pulling the hay and so forth. It's quite beautiful.
Yeah. Return to Form. Tree of Life is a beautiful movie. Return to Form indeed. Physically, he's using wide-angle lenses in almost every shot. Not just every scene,
and
but every shot.
Wow.
And that's that low-floating Steadicam.
Yeah.
Very many of the shots are outside. So because he's using this wide-angle, everything is in focus into the middle ground, foreground, background. Always in focus, because he wants to bring us into this world as deeply as he possibly can. Franz Jägerstätter, Austrian farmer and conscientious objector, all of this. He was executed in 1943. and beatified in 2007 by Pope Benedict, I believe, which was sort of controversial even at the time. But this is that story, and it's told with these letters, lots of voiceover between these letters between him and his wife that they wrote when he was away in prison. Beautiful writing, beautiful filmmaking, not at the top of my parents'
alley. It's as strong as it has a beginning and an end. It does flow as a narrative.
Which is always helpful.
Yes, unlike many of his films.
A Hidden Life from writer-director Terrence Malick. It's rated PG-13 at the ArcLight Hollywood, the Landmark in West L.A. And the biographical film Seberg on actress Jean Seberg stars Kristen Stewart, Benedict Andrews, the director. Tim?
Yeah, very interesting. Benedict made a movie called Una a couple of years ago with Mooney Rara. This is about Jean Seberg, who, of course, was in Otto Preminger's St. Joan. It was her first film. She was burned very badly in that film, Jean Seberg. She was an American, but she lived most of her life in France, spoke fluent France. In the middle 60s, she came back to the United States to work in Hollywood, and she got involved with the Black Panthers, a particular Black Panther. The FBI started investigating her and making her life. Now, the framing device in this movie of the FBI agent, I don't like that at all. Mm-hmm. That needs to go away completely from this movie. Miss Stewart, again, is just extraordinary. I got to tell you, Kristen Stewart is just one of the most wonderful actresses this country has known in a decade. And when she was a little girl, I used to poke her so badly. She was too contemporary, just all kinds of things. But as a young woman, she's just one of the most wonderful. And she inhabits this performance. She is extraordinary in this movie. She's the thing, much more so than the movie itself.
Yeah, fantastic casting with her pixie cut. She looks just like Jean Seberg in Breathless, which of course was one of her most famous films.
Yeah.
And you know, I think and Stewart, of course, is a great heroine of the French. They adore her because she speaks French as well. And she's well cast. The costumes are great. I just thought it wasn't a particularly well written film. It could have been a lot stronger. And I didn't love the direction either.
Benedict Andrews directed. Joe Shrapnel and Anna Waterhouse were the screenwriters. The film Seberg is rated R. You can see it at Lemley's Town Center Theater in Encino, and it's to be released sometime next year on Amazon Prime, rated R. Also want to talk about the animation show of shows. Charles, what are some of the films you'd like to tell?
You know, this has been a year where so many of the big studio animated films were disappointments, either aesthetically or financially, and this show is a very welcome reminder that there's another side of animation, which is a very personal extension of the traditional fine arts. And so the use of color and graphics and content people making personal statements. I particularly liked a French film by Joanna Lurie that's done in these beautiful watercolor scenes, creating a magical sea where they're having a funeral and the souls of the dead become these sort of jellyfish-like creatures that swim off into a new dimension. Another one, Recette de Soie from Belgium, it uses multimedia, mixed media, shifting media to present the story of a young woman who at the onset of puberty realizes she wants to be a boy. She's always seen herself as a boy. And now how is she going to deal with that? And it's a kind of very comforting film for young people who find themselves in that situation. But on the other hand, completely silly is Rubicon, which is a whole series of variations on you have a sheep, a wolf, and a cabbage. And how do you get all three of them across with only one boat? And they keep shifting pace and different things happen to them. And it's just this little absurdity. It's almost like a little Baroque piece of music where how many variations on one theme can we do? It's just fun, and pretty much everything in the show, with one or two exceptions, just reminds you that animation is more than these big studio productions.
This is the 21st annual animation show of shows, and Ron Diamond, the founder and curator of it, so he finds these films.
Yeah, from the festival circuit and all over the world.
It's for the next week at Lemley's Glendale Theaters, where you can see the 21st annual animation show of shows. Also, we have sad news to report. Actor Danny Aiello passed away at the age of 86. I remember him from such films as Do the Right Thing, Moonstruck, Once Upon a Time in America. And his breakthrough was as the hapless lover dumped by Cher in Norman Jewison's hit comedy Moonstruck.
Will you marry me? All right. You know I was married and that my husband died, but what you don't know is I think he and I had bad luck.
What do you mean?
Well, we got married down at the city hall, and I think it gave bad luck the whole marriage.
I don't understand.
Right from the start, we didn't do it right, okay? Could you kneel down?
On the floor?
Yeah, on the floor.
This is a good suit.
I know that. I helped you pick it out. It came with two pairs of pants.
Cher and Danny Aiello, who died at the age of 86, passing away Friday after a short illness. For our Film Week critics, I'm Larry Mantle. Thank you so much for joining us for our weekly edition of the program. And again, we'd love to see you in person at the Theater at Ace Hotel Sunday morning, February 2nd, 11 o'clock for our annual Academy Awards preview with all of our critics on stage. Tickets, kpecc.org/in-person. Have a wonderful week, and next week we got many more big films to talk about. Talk to you then.